Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Don't forget, this is a credit union, which means it belongs to you. Before we start our conversation about what's going on in Europe and Greece and the Arab Spring, from Libya to Tunisia to Greece and more, we want to talk about what's going on right here in Baltimore. Casey McKeel joins us. She's a member of the legal team for Occupy Baltimore. There's been a lot of conversation about the mayor's office telling them that they have to leave and move out. We want to find out the real story from the perspective of Occupy Baltimore. We'll also be talking to the mayor's office at some point as well. And Casey McKeel, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So, to tell us what is going on, what is the story from your perspective about what we're reading about in terms of the city wanting to move Occupy Baltimore off the space they're in?
Well, we applied for a permit after the city requested that we do so about a week ago or so, a little bit over. And just over the weekend, we received the first formal proposal from the city regarding the response to the permit application that we submitted. And though they were not willing to issue a permit to us, they, you know, gave us this proposal of things to consider. And I think one first and foremost thing to stress is that it is a draft proposal. The top of the document, you know, says draft, and it is the first formal response that we've had from them. And so basically, it has a number of different points of concern that they have, and it states at the top that if these rules are followed, the Occupy Baltimore group will not be arrested for trespass or park rule violations resulting from the lack of a valid permit. So it's sort of what they, I take, it's sort of what they plan to do instead of issuing us a permit is set up this other sort of agreement with us. And at the bottom, I think what caused some of the commotion today was that it says we would be given until Wednesday, the 26th, to comply. So we brought this up last night, a member of the legal committee did, to the General Assembly. And then we had a lawyer on hand to sort of, you know, do some question and answer about it, and did not reach any conclusions as of yet, and wanted just to continue that conversation again tonight before getting back to the city. And today we actually did try to follow up with Fran Spiro, but didn't get a chance to actually talk with her yet. So that's sort of where things stand at the moment.
It seems that we did try to call the city. The Parks and Rec declined to give us a statement. The city hasn't returned our call yet. Which may mean that they're not quite sure how to do this and are trying to mull it over themselves, because without having kind of the public egg on their face by forcing people off the site.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm guessing is probably the case.
So what are you asking people of Baltimore to do who support Occupy Baltimore?
Well, right now we're encouraging all allies to join the encampment. The more people, the better, obviously, to have down there. You know, we've had a lot of people down there each night for general assemblies as well as for all the actions. But right now, you know, it's a really critical time just to show support. You know, if you support the movement, it'd be great to have people down there tonight for the general assembly and, you know, bring a sleeping bag, bring a tent and camp out, you know, support what's going on down there.
And what time is the general assembly?
It's at 8 p.m.
We'll check in with you tomorrow and stop by tomorrow as well to see what's going on if we can't stop by tonight as well. And we'll stay on top of this with you and let the folks know what's happening.
All right.
Casey, thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
Casey McKeel is a member of the legal team for Occupy Baltimore. We've been kind of covered that. Look at Occupy Washington, Occupy New York. We just did get a statement. We just lost Casey. If she wants to hear the statement, we can let her come back in. This is a statement from the city of Baltimore. At the request of Mayor Rawlings Blake, city leaders and attorneys have met to discuss ways to protect individuals' right to protest. City government is committed to protecting the free speech rights of Baltimore citizens, and that is why Any citizen is free to peacefully demonstrate at McKeldin Plaza in accordance with established guidelines. McKeldin Plaza, however, is not a campground, and overnight camping is prohibited. The city will continue to monitor the situation and deal with individual acts of illegal behavior on a case-by-case basis. Casey, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
So what's your response to that?
Well, it definitely addresses the most contentious part of their proposal, which would be, you know, asking us not to camp there. We would love to work with the city, I think, you know, as much as possible in order to peacefully assemble and express, you know, freedom of speech. We have been told by some of the lawyers that we've been working with from the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild that, you know, the First Amendment right doesn't necessarily protect us to camp there indefinitely. However, you know, we are hoping to be able to continue to do so because this is something that's happening, you know, all over the country, and other people are camping out. Philly and D.C. nearby have been allowed to continue to camp there, so we would love to be able to do the same here in Baltimore. This is a huge part of occupying the free space, is actually being able to maintain that presence. But, this is something I guess we will bring up tonight at the General Assembly and see what sort of decision we can make on whether or not we want to continue to do so.
Well, we'll check in with you maybe during the assembly or just after and see what happens, and we'll see what we can put on the air and keep the world abreast of all this. And Casey, thanks so much, and good luck.
All right, thank you.
Take care. Casey McKeel, member of the legal team for Occupy Baltimore. And we will keep up with that and the other Occupy New York and Occupy Washington, and we've just heard of Occupy Lancaster, which is taking place in Pennsylvania, just north of here. Right now we are switching gears to talk about what's happening overseas. We have with us in the studio Kostis Papadantonakis, who's an economist and former professor at Essex Community College, who just got back from Greece. And Kostis, good to have you in the studio. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And Bill Fletcher is with us. He's a columnist for BlackCommentator.com. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and will be speaking about the Arab Spring this Sunday, October 30th, at 7 p.m. here in Baltimore at the 2640 space. That's 2640 St. Paul Street here in downtown Baltimore in Charles Village. At 7 p.m. And Bill Fletcher, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
I'm glad to be back on the program. Thanks.
So this is a... Were you about to say something? So this is a... We're watching what's going on in Europe and in the Middle East right now is interesting on lots of levels. And let me just start with Bill Fletcher with what we're seeing happening in North Africa. We see from the combination of... watching this Tunisian election, it took place today, in which that's my phone. I meant to turn. I should never have this phone on when I'm on the air. We were watching what's going on in Tunisia, where they have the first free election ever in the history of the country, new democracy, which America is going to have to address somehow. Where the plurality of vote was won by a moderate Islamist party, similar to the one that's in power in Turkey, in many ways. That says we don't want to force people to wear headscarves, nor not to wear them, is one of the lines they used during the election. But also seeing that large numbers of people voted for more left-wing liberal and democratic parties as well. And a coalition government is going to be formed. You see what happens in Libya with Gaddafi and the oil field starting to pump again. So just before I go on and on with this list ad nauseum, Bill, give us your analysis of what you see as going on overarching in especially those two places.
Well, I think that overall, the so-called Arab Spring has been incredibly exciting, dynamic, and along with the green movement that took place in Iran, I think helps to explain the massive movements that we've seen in Europe and now in the United States in opposition to economic injustice. I think that people were very, very deeply inspired by these movements. That said, these movements were very, very complicated.
Yes.
And part of what I think we're seeing is that contrary to the mythology that often is associated with anarchism, that is that spontaneous movements emerge and they just sweep forward, et cetera. These movements are very complex, and at the end of the day, the forces that are the best well-organized are those that are able to take advantage of these unique moments in time. So what you see is, whether it's in Egypt or Tunisia or Libya, is that some of the best organized forces have been the Islamists. Now, one of the reasons for this is that in many of these countries, the left has been crushed. I don't mean that the left became despairing. I mean that the governments that were overthrown often conspired, in some sense, in some cases, with some of these same Islamist forces to destroy the organized left. This is certainly what happened in Egypt. It happened in the Sudan and a number of other places. So that the opposition, the main organized opposition, ends up being the Islamists. So I think that that's one of the things that we're seeing unfold. I think that the response in the United States and to some extent in Europe is one of promoting panic. And you almost believe when you read some things that Al-Qaeda had taken over in a number of these places. And what we have to also understand is that these Islamist movements are not Al-Qaeda. They're not variations of Al-Qaeda. That, in fact, the Arab democratic uprisings were the worst nightmare for Al-Qaeda, because they were popular, they were democratic, they were non-sectarian in a religious sense, and they went against virtually everything that Islamic fundamentalists have advocated. So that's why it's important to look at this and understand the complexities of these movements.
And I, when you watch what's going on in those countries, it's all very different. And the U.S. response is really interesting to just look at as well. I mean, Tunisia is where it all began, and it spread across North Africa. Tunisia is a very, among many of those countries, maybe as well as Morocco, as we call it, quote-unquote, more westernized than other nations in North Africa, just in terms of its relationship to France. But when you watch what's going on in each country, I mean, when you look at the vote that took place in Tunisia today, what struck me as I looked at the vote, and it was that even though the modern Islamist party won close to 40%, if not 40% of the vote, much of the other vote, the other 60%, was divided up into a lot of much more secular parties.
Correct. And what's interesting about that is that there was something like 80 parties that were involved in this. I was in Tunisia in June,
and I was
there for several days, mainly talking with labor union people. And as you know, the labor federation in Tunisia was one of the leading forces in the revolution. And one of the things that's interesting about Tunisia is that it has an organized left. I don't mean a left like a Bill Clinton left. I mean like a real left. Right, and they have a real left. They have a real labor movement, and you're right that the vote was divided up among a number of these forces, which is to be expected.
Number here is 410-319-8888. You can join this conversation at any time. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And we're going to spend some of our show today looking at something beyond our borders here and beyond America's shores, and looking at what's going on and how it affects what's happening in our country and around the rest of the world, because we're watching also Greece very closely. Kostis Papadantonakis, an economist, has just come back from Greece, country that you were born. and it's been fascinating to watch. I said before we went on the air that many people who look at what's going on in Europe are envious of what the Greeks have done in standing up to what they see as these austerity packages and the banks ruling every piece of governance in Greece, even though the legislation has been passed despite the demonstrations. So, I mean, talk about what your analysis of what's going on there and what you saw when you were there.
Hello, Bill. Good to be on the air with you. What is happening is that while the people on the south shore of the Mediterranean, on the African shore of the Mediterranean, have their repressive governments on the run and have been overthrowing them. On the other side, the governments are acting as agents of international economy and international capital in really trying to get the people on the run. And so what you see in Greece, much as you see in Spain and other places on the European side, is people regrouping and people resisting. So it's resistance rather than a revolution that marks the situation there. And it's resistance against what really, and we have to put that in perspective since you started your program with Baltimore Occupied, which is part of the Wall Street Occupied movement, that this is collateral damage from the big crisis that was wrought upon the world by the recklessness of unregulated and supremely dominant banking, world banking, which fed the whole world and Greece and the Greek government, among others, recklessly with money because they were swimming in money back during the bubble that has been created through so much inequality in this country to begin with so much money in the hands of rich people who won't spend it on anything other than trying to make more money, and speculation is the way to go, or was the way to go. And so that led to the bankruptcy that has made Greece as one of the most vulnerable parts of that part of the world and that part of the world economy face the need to have austerity. And that's a need that's imposed by world banking and the socialists, quote-unquote, that's the formal title of the ruling party in Greece, the Socialist Party, is enforcing. And that has terrible dimensions, which I can go into. But the point is that people facing massive unemployment, looking at union busting systematically, looking at deliberate inflation through regressive taxes, and a privatization which really loots all public resources, public lands, some of them ancient lands that are being sold privately, and public corporations also, public utilities. People are resisting against that, and that's the mobilization that you see now, and that is the fight, and that is the parallel between what is happening on the other shore of the Mediterranean.
We're going to open the phones here. Kosti Papadantonakis is with us, who just came back from Greece. Talk about what happened in Greece, the connections here. Bill Fletcher, who has spent time in North Africa, columnist for BlackCommentator.com, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who will be here this Sunday evening, October the 30th, at 7 o'clock at 2640 St. Paul Street, speaking about the Arab Spring. Let's get a couple calls in here and go back to my thoughts. 410-319-8888. Clarence in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Hi, Clarence. Welcome.
I'm thinking of a word, and it's based on something I read years ago where Plato was describing the inferior forms of government. And I kind of get the impression that all over the world, whether it's a consciousness or unconscious by the uneducated or conscious of it by the educated, that every government that exists nowadays is, I think the word is allegorical in nature, where a small group of people, banks, water, corporates, amass all the power and call all the shots. And related to what happened on Wall Street and with the financial crisis in the world, people all over the world are seeing that there's something terribly wrong, whether it's socialism, capitalism, or anything else. People all over the world are seeing that something is terribly wrong with the way not only America, but the world is being run. That's basically my question, if anybody else would agree or disagree or elaborate on that.
That's an interesting thought, Clarence. And let's start with Bill Fletcher. I mean, I think that I was going to where I was thinking about as we were talking about the connections between the banking crisis here, the banking crisis that could just literally have a bottom fallout in Europe, and why we're so nervous and worried about it, and also have our feet firmly planted in the Arab Muslim world?
Well, I think that there's a number of different things that are unfolding. We have to be very careful that we don't collapse everything together. I think that, for example, what we're seeing, as was just described, what Kostas was just describing about Greece, that we're looking at an economic crisis that is the fusion of two different things. One is a crisis within capitalism of an overaccumulation of capital and wealth, in addition to a financial crisis that exploded in 2008. And the fusion of these two things has led to this devastating situation that we've been experiencing ever since. Now, in the Arab world, part of what's happened is that the Arab world has been forced by the United States and Europe over years to follow economic policies that were destroying it. And at the same time, you ironically had in a number of countries young people, well-educated, coming out of schools and finding absolutely no work, much as we're finding in the United States right now, and growing discontent when the governments that had bowed down to the West refused to take the steps that were necessary to address the depth of this kind of crisis. And so we started to see things explode. But the thing that I think is important for the listener to get is that this did not come out of nowhere. This was not, whether it was in Greece or whether it was in Tunisia, this wasn't a Facebook revolution. Facebook, the web, et cetera, all helped as communication and organizing mechanisms. But there were organizations and various groupings that for years had been plugging away, including the labor movement.
I agree with Bill, and I also agree with the listener that the result of the present structure in the world is that oligarchies, as he said, are ruling in much of the world. And in the case of the countries that have been more privileged to have escaped outright colonialism sooner than others, and that is perhaps one of the differences between the two shores of the Mediterranean, I was saying. The kind of repression that people are facing now is one that's trying to put them back in the bag, as it were, and make the difference between the South European economies, which are in absolutely no better shape in many cases than the economies of North Africa. Share the standard of living on which has been foisted and forced upon the people of on the African side of the Mediterranean for a very long time, and that is what people are resisting there. Just as the people on the other side are struggling to upend that. So in that sense, there is a similarity. But I agree that one has to be very careful, and cannot say that the one area where I would disagree with what the listener suggested is that whether they are on the right or the left, or the regimes are the same. And it seems to me that we're looking at regimes that, by any other name, and that's why I was emphasizing the term socialists in Greece, are in fact part of what here we would call the right, which unfortunately may include the Democrats quite for much of the policies that we see right now in this country. And these are people who are willing, in the case of Greece and other small countries, to enforce the requisites of world banking and to put by priority the resources of the country to salvage bankers. People are being overtaxed. People are being fired. They're told their schools are being cut back and all these things so as to pay higher interest rates on the existing loans. I mean, this is what's happening in Greece right now. And this is what's being faced by all the other countries who are being downgraded. And so in that sense, what you have is governments doing the bidding of something which at the global level has to be identified. You want to call that oligarchy? Being an economist, I would call it world capital. And I think that's perhaps an inevitable tendency of the way in which capitalism works, that there's this terrific concentration, and either you use the governments as representatives of the people to resist that concentration and to regulate it and to replace it by something more rational and more human, or you allow and tolerate those governments doing the bidding of that concentrated power.
I'm going to get another call here. I want to come back to what both of you just said and kind of examine it more and talk about a study which we'll attach to our website that I was sent to me by another economist friend of ours from Chicago that was done in Switzerland that looks at the network of global corporate control. It was not done by left-wingers. This was done by a think tank looking at complex systems. I think in many ways to try to figure out how capitalists have saved themselves from themselves. Well, they analyzed 43,000 transnational corporations and winnowed them down to 1,300, and then winnowed down more to 150 that had cross-fertilization of boards and investments that really control up to 6% of the world economy. They're almost all financial organizations. But we'll talk about that and its relationship to all this in a minute as well. That's a really fascinating report that we'll wrestle with in a little bit. But let me get a caller in here, as I promised, before we do that, before we go to break. And, Key, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you so much for taking my call. I attempted to call yesterday and got kind of agitated, but I'm glad I did get a chance to say something today. First of all, Mark, I want to thank you for what you do, and I mean that very sincerely. Because you've always been consistent. You know how far we go back with struggling in Baltimore.
Yes.
As well as internationally and the like. One other thing I want to say is this, that the thing that outrages me, and there's a black rage that rages in me, I could call it an African rage, is that when we begin to talk about what happens on the continent of Africa, I underscore Africa. I didn't say Arab Africa. I didn't say sub-Saharan Africa. I said Africa, which is not only a geographical place, it's a consciousness that has pervaded this little small dot called Earth, that we have a tendency to get a sense of amnesia. I went on my first demonstration at the age of 4. I'll be 60 to some of the second if I'm allowed to live on this planet any longer, right? And all I'm saying is I was the first one arrested at the Inner Harbor when you talk about the occupation of Baltimore and the linkage thereof. The point I'm making is this. It's been a part of a whole lot of movies like yourself and your guests and the like, and it becomes, in my opinion, a type of paternalism, unexpectedly, unintended, but a type of paternalism. On a historical black college where I went to Morgan, and I had professors there, as I went to Douglas and other places around the country, as letters on the continent of Africa. And what we hear is a discussion around what's going on in the continent of Africa from an Arab, socialist, leftist, academic perspective. And it's totally unfair because we all know, even if you talk about capital and the banks and the like, that is what is in the womb of Mother Africa, those 21 strategic minerals, that no industrialized country can operate without continuing to rape Mother Africa. So whether it's a Gaddafi in charge or Mubarak, and Lord knows people need justice, and the African people have been dominated by the Arab people in those North African countries, they need liberation also, as they do in Baltimore. So I just want to say one last thing and thank you for your patience.
So go ahead, Doc.
Thank you. So as we talk about what's going on the continent of Africa, let us open our minds and our understanding so we can hear Africans on their own terms. Emil Cabral said, return to the source. Tell no lies, claim no easy victories. It is not just about capital. You know, it is not just about the movement of banks. It is not just about Arab people wanting democracy. Who hell don't want democracy or a fair voice? So thank you very much for hearing me. And I will hope between Amy Goodman in the morning for a couple of hours and Mark Steiner in the evening on Morgan State Radio University doing an excellent job, at some point we can find some black voices from an African perspective to have our own voice and not be modified by anybody.
Thank you. And I would say we do have a multiplicity of voices here from Greece to African-American to mine on this show tonight. But we're going to take a very brief break and come back, as we do all the time. We'll come back from this break and tackle what Daki, the critique he gave us, and look at more issues surrounding what's going on in Europe, especially in North Africa and the Arab Spring, and how it affects America and what America has to do with it all. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Bill Fletcher, columnist for the BlackCommentator.com, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, who will be speaking this Sunday night, October the 30th at 7 p.m. about the Arab Spring at 2640 St. Paul Street in Baltimore, which is in Charles Village, the 2640 space, the old church. Kosis Papadantonakis is with us, who is an economist and former professor at Essex Community College. He also just returned from Greece. Number is 410-319-8888. And, Bill, would you like to tackle a bit of what Daki was talking about before he went to break?
I had mixed feelings about what he said. So let me just start with one point that I absolutely agree, that Africa is a continent. North Africa is part of Africa. And that, I mean, that should be obvious, but it's actually the case that for years in schools, we were taught that North Africa was more closely aligned with Europe than it was anything else. So I think that the caller is right to emphasize this. I was unclear, though, when he basically seemed to be talking about Arab domination of Africans as if this was in the 1500s. I mean, what's important to understand about North Africa is that there's an incredible mixture of peoples in Northern Africa, Arabs, Berbers, other groups, there's immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa that exist there, and their interrelationship is very complicated, something which we started to see in the context of the Libyan uprising. And so I think that to the extent that I understand what the caller was saying, I think we have to look at this, but we can't look at this through the prism of the eyes of people in North America, because race and color play themselves out very differently on the continent than they do here. And I think that when we look, as an African-American, which I am, at North Africa through the eyes of an African-American, and we look at race as if it is just simply the United States imposed on North Africa, we miss the nuance. And so I would caution the caller.
Go ahead, Kosti.
Yes. I would like to add to that my perspective. I come from the island of Crete, which is equidistant between the shore of Europe and the shores of Africa, and has been for seven centuries part of an African empire in recent times, and for perhaps 2 to 3 millennia part of another African empire back in ancient times, for the first part of the Pharaoh Empire and more recently part of the great Muslim Empire, the Caliphate, from the 7th century on for a number of centuries. And the point is that the Mediterranean, which is what I have been talking about as having the two shores, and perhaps triggered this complaint by the caller also, has been a cauldron mixing the people and producing people who are really unified. I mean, it's not populated by Europeans and Africans as distinct human beings, as distinct races. This is a construct of the history, a construct of passport authorities, a construct of who has euros and who doesn't, and things of that sort. And it has nothing to do with the reality of what the people are like, what the problems the people are facing. And so it is very important, I think, to emphasize that people learn looking at each other. I mean, the Greek people are looking at the struggle of people in the Middle East. They're looking at the Palestinian struggle. They're looking at the people who are resisting the oil grabbing in all the oil-rich countries further east. They're looking at the people in North Africa, and they're looking at these uprisings. They're being inspired, and they feel a sense of solidarity, even though at the same time, there is a whole lot of propaganda that's trying to tell them, no, you're different. You're Europeans. You know, you have euros, for which you have to pay through the nose nowadays, and things of that sort. It seems to me that one has to realize that we're looking at a world which has a human history which goes very, very deep and is unified and indivisible, and it is being divided by artificial means for administrative and colonial administrative, quite often, purposes.
Right. I would agree 100%.
So before we go back to the phones and we go to Maisha and Baba, who are the first next two callers up, when we see what's going on in the Arab world at the moment, I'm curious what you both think, and start with both Fletcher, how this plays out. I mean, and then we'll go to Southern Europe and see what could happen there and how this could maybe what's unfolding in front of the worldwide capitalist system. Whether you have Tunisia this election, where Libya is in disarray. Some people today in some of the more established papers are writing about Americans now have to be involved in Libya to keep it from becoming Somalia, have to be involved in Libya to ensure that Italy and France have the oil that they need, and what role that plays to the democracy movement in Egypt, to what U.S. ignores in Bahrain and Syria with the murders of thousands of civilians by those governments, and the kind of instability going on with all this. And Bill Fletcher, I know you'll be talking a bit about this on Sunday, but can you comment on that and tie some of that together?
Well, let me give it a shot, at least for part of it. So first of all, I would say that the Arab Democratic Uprising needs to also be seen in the context of democratic uprisings that have been taking place in other parts of the continent of Africa, which have not received a great deal of attention. Democratic movements, for example, in Senegal, in the Cote d'Ivoire, in Zimbabwe, that have simply not received much in the way of mainstream attention. And I think that there's a racial reason that they did not receive that kind of attention. The second thing is that these movements, as we saw in Iran, where there was massive historic movements, can also decline and lose energy if they're not connected to a process aimed at social transformation. In other words, it's not enough to protest. And I don't mean this in a condescending way at all. What I mean is that protests are very important, but ultimately it needs to be linked to some sort of process of social transformation. Otherwise, the inevitable tendency would be towards some sort of retreat. And we've seen that. I mean, historically, you could use the great example of Italy in 1919, where there was massive worker upsurges that were not connected to a fight for power. The upsurges declined, and what came in its place was fascism. And so I think we have to understand that these movements are very exciting. How they will play out will depend to a great extent on the organized forces that are contained there. And I think that's a lesson across the planet.
Let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888 and come back to what could happen if there's a default going on in Greece and how that unfolds, and with the European and American banks being so interlocked, interrelated, what could happen once that takes place, and what some people are seeing as a great unraveling, though it could take years to unravel completely. And 410-319-8888, Maisha, you're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to speak to the racism that I heard discussed, you know, to try and say that genocide of any form is okay, and try to diffuse and say that the melting pot that exists made it all right. All a group that is supposed to be for democracy that held workers that were African and eliminated villages. I mean, right now, they're being investigated for doing that and calling that and crouching that as a democratic movement. And I know historically democratic movements have, in fact, committed genocide in terms of European colonialism in this country, mm-hmm. the genocide against the American Indian. But in today's world, for it to be crouched as democracy and some kind of positive movement that results in mass murder,
what are you talking about specifically?
I'm talking about in Libya, there's whole towns of Africans that were eliminated.
Oh, yes.
There's whole
right.
towns that right. have been reported where they can't come back, and nobody knows where the people are. They have showed truckloads of Africans that were killed. They showed them laying across the desert,
right.
done by these militia. So how do we eliminate all of that from our vision and call that democracy some kind of righteous struggle?
No, I think, Maisha, you raise an important point. And as somebody said the other day, and we'll wrestle with what you just said right now. Somebody said the other day on realnews.com in an interview who was an expert on Libyan, was Libyan, said, you know, look, there are a lot of things to say how bad Gaddafi was. But clearly, there's been a racist attack against Africans who are working in Libya. It could be killed by the hundreds, if not thousands. And B, even though Gaddafi might have been a madman in his own right, there was free education, free health care, the highest literacy rate, the lowest mortality rate in the entire Arab world. So it's not as easy, Bill Fletcher, as black and white, not to use those two.
You know, this is, I think we have to really investigate carefully what happened. Because part of what went down is that Gaddafi had been playing on this issue of color. Sub-Saharan and North Africa contradictions for years. His going to Sub-Saharan Africa to get mercenaries to suppress the democratic uprising was a cold, calculated operation on his part. And so this was not someone who was particularly enlightened on this. He was very, very shrewd. And I think that one thing we have to be very clear on with Gaddafi is that, you know, it was great that he supported the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, but what about Sierra Leone? What about Liberia? I mean, this is very, very complicated. Part of what happened in this Libyan civil war is that some of the villages that supported Gaddafi carried out atrocities against villages that opposed and vice versa. So I think that where I would agree with the caller is that this entire situation has to be investigated. The other thing that's important to understand, and it was very clear to me when I was in North Africa, is that the people, the issue of color is very complicated. You know, some of the people that were anti-Gaddafi were jet black. Some of the people that were pro-Gaddafi were jet black. I mean, this is why I went back to, I raised a thing before about we can't look at the situation there as if we're looking at a fight going on in the middle of Baltimore or in the middle of New York. Race and color play themselves out in a very different set of ways in North Africa. This is not at all to excuse atrocities, but it's to say that you got to look at the situation in much more depth. Gaddafi had been playing on this issue of immigration to Libya for a while as a way of dividing and conquering the people within Libya.
Let's go back to the phone. Costi, you want to add to that?
Only a footnote to say that once the cork comes out of that evil bottle and people start killing each other, all of these contradictions come out and are played out with death and massacres and these horrors. And the whole issue is how far to stop that from happening. And here we have to allocate some responsibility. I mean, Gaddafi, by all accounts, was a monster, but this upending of Gaddafi in such a ruthless way, such a massive way, with the NATO bombings, with all of these things, and with the promotion of the violence that created these retaliatory massacres, was done without, it seems, any much consideration of its consequences. And so those who are responsible for that kind of push and for that kind of solution of a problem that they tolerated for 42 years, collaborating with Gaddafi, using Gaddafi, and opening up relations with Gaddafi again, as the United States did in recent years, suddenly taking this cavalier and ruthless attitude, callous attitude, toward the consequences. That, I think, that is part of what the caller was pointing at, and that has to be acknowledged also.
And I think that before we go to Baba, and I do want to get back to Greece for the end of the hour as well, because I think it's critical to talk about what could happen if that falls apart. That if you look at, I mean, the way the American press plays a lot of it, at least from what I've been reading, that this is, we're not doing this for egalitarian and reasons of democracy while we're in Libya, at the same time while we're not confronting Syria or Bahrain, while we're not going to push Egypt too hard to create a real democracy, because we have our own hegemonic balance that the Western businesses in America wants to, when in the West wants to play out in this place. And so this is, we're not, the bombs didn't fall in Libya necessarily to liberate the Libyan people, I don't think. Bill?
I think that the U.S. hypocrisy, the hypocrisy of this administration and the historic hypocrisy of the U.S. on all of these matters is just, is almost beyond the... It's almost like out of science fiction. I mean, what you were describing about Bahrain, the level of repression carried out by this U.S.-backed, Saudi-backed clique is monstrous. And, I mean, you're talking about the medical personnel who treated demonstrators being jailed.
Right.
You're talking about the massive repression of the labor movement. You're talking about the clique that happens to be Sunni playing on religious issues as a way of splitting the opposition. Yet the United States has done almost nothing. I mean, you know, a few fine words from Obama and from Clinton, but, I mean, nothing more than that. I mean, when you look at that kind of repression, you know, and you look at the fact that the Saudis intervened, yet there was no U.S. military threat. There was no threat on the part of the United States to blow up Saudi tanks as they crossed the causeways coming into Bahrain. So, I mean, this is one of the things that's so upsetting about looking at what happened in Libya, that, you know, we had all of these fine words about how the NATO countries had to stand together to stop Gaddafi from this massive repression. Yet, whether it was Yemen or Bahrain, no, because those countries were key allies of the United States. Libya, you know, truth be told, was also an ally of the United States, had to become one, but was not critical in the same way that Bahrain and Yemen are.
Let's go back to the phones very quickly. Baba, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Baba, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. How you doing?
Well, welcome.
This is my opinion on the Arab Spring and Arab uprising. I have property in Nigeria myself, and the Nigerians there and Africans in there, and also in Ghana, will tell you that the Arabs enslaved the Africans before the Europeans did. There's a group of people, an ethnic group of people called the Egbas in Nigeria. I have visited them and their stronghold, and they will show you when they had to go up in the mountains for hundreds of years. A singer named Fela in the town of Obeokuta has the history to fight off Arab invasions, and also in Ghana for over 300 years. The Arabs, 300 years. And Gaddafi was not a bad man. He was very much so civilized. The ones that were mad were France, England, and these countries, and Germany, the ones that committed the atrocities on here. So when we get these type, hear these type of terms and whatnot, like I say, I have property there, and family members there too, in Nigeria, in Lagos, and a place called Ile Ife, the spiritual city of the Yoruba people, and they have the history of the worst atrocities committed on Africans and also in Ghana by the Arabs. They enslaved the African long before the European did,
right,
and also of that barbarian Greek that came in there.
Baba, thanks for your thoughts today. I kind of wander way back into what's going on, but in these struggles in the Arab world and in Greece. If we see the Greeks in default on their loan, which many people think is going to happen, and there could be a great unraveling all through Europe that affects the United States.
That's true. What we see is a regulated and controlled defaulting at this point, with the great powers of Europe, meaning the Germans primarily and then the French and secondarily, negotiating how to allow, on the one hand, the relative bankruptcy of Greece, and on the other hand, how to save their banks from the bankruptcy that will threaten them, because they hold a whole lot of those IOUs. And I should mention that those banks very greedily bought big, especially when it became very clear that because Greece was in trouble, they would be forced to pay much higher interest rates. So those IOUs that now the Greek government cannot afford to pay back have been paying enormous interest rates, have been promising enormous interest rates. And so these people have been speculating, these bankers have been speculating, and they were speculating knowing at some level that if they lose, they won't lose because the taxpayers of the richer countries of Europe and their over-squeezed taxpayers of the poor countries like Greece would pay them, would make up for it. So I think that the expectation is that Europe would have to decide whether they will collectively bail out the banks that will suffer from such a bankruptcy, or they are going to force the banks to eat a whole lot of the losses in order to save the political union of Europe. Ironically, I think that if they try to save the banks, the explosiveness of the cost for bailing out the banks will threaten the unity of the European Union, which is rather fragile still. And of course, countries that will have to pay a whole lot of the share of that bailing out and do not have direct stakes in the banks that are going to be bailed out are going to object. And this is already happening. So depending on how this debate goes, it may mean that the banks will have to suffer more or less. If the banks suffer more, then our banks will suffer more also. So I think that the global financial system is under threat to the extent that the greediness that has cumulatively brought us to this point is resisted politically in an effort to maintain some sort of European unity, politically speaking. That at least is my take on what is at stake.
And Bill, it seems at stake here. I mean, what we're saying also is that this is also part of what some people see as the great unraveling. If the governments don't support the banks, the capitalist system is in trouble.
Well, the capitalist system has been in trouble
for a while.
Indeed.
And one of the things that has kept pulling it out are these speculative bubbles, whether it was .com or housing and real estate or pet rocks or whatever. But I think that the system itself has been in trouble. The question will be the resolution and what demands to be put on government. And that's one of the reasons that these mass movements, whether it's in Greece or North Africa, are so critical. And I really encourage your listeners to keep in mind the character of these movements. They're complex. But the general democratic with a small d objective of getting rid of oppressive regimes, getting rid of economic systems imposed upon them that are driving them into deeper and deeper poverty, this is something to be applauded. That doesn't mean that everybody that's involved in these are noble, but it means that masses of people, after years of incredible oppression, are standing up and are resisting.
This is
marvelous.
This has been a fascinating hour. I appreciate your time from both of you. I want you all to meet Bill Fletcher this Sunday at the 2640 St. Paul Street in the Old Church 2640 space on St. Paul Street in Charles Village, 7 p.m. October 30th this Sunday. He'll be speaking about the Arab Spring and more. He's columnist for the blackcommentator.com, senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. And our other guest today will be there as well, Kosi Papadantonakis.
Looking forward to it.
Economist and former professor at Essex Community College. Bill Fletcher and Kosi Papadantonakis, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We take a break. When we return, we're going to come back to Baltimore and look at a very interesting creative effort around our red line. So stay with us. Don't go away.